The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's good to be back with you here at the start of another work week, Monday morning, Monday afternoon, wherever it is that you might be for this live stream. Speaking of that, we had a special Saturday live edition of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We had, just adding up all of the platforms that we put the program on, we had over 1,500 connections to the broadcast live, and then I think since that time, YouTube is showing about 4,000 views, so quite a few people have watched it after the fact as well. I'll start with just a few emails from our listeners. This one from New Jersey says, what a stirring, inspiring Sabbath TD. As an 80-year-old and affected by some old age problems, I now realize how God views death and the death of his beloved son. It is pleasing to him to see death. Christ was victorious. He made the way for us all. People now want to hang on to this physical life. However, even as these older people die of this virus, few realize that these are actually being delivered from their painful, agonizing old-aged conditions and put to peaceful sleep to awaken over 1,000 years later in a reformed world governed by God, with an opportunity to be taught the truth and to live God's way and to become his own glorified children. She's pointing out, obviously, the grand purpose and plan that God has for mankind and how that it includes everyone when it's all said and done. Another one here from South Carolina says, my wife and I just finished watching your live message this morning. You declared the crucifixion very clearly. I was brought to tears numerous times as you described what Christ went through for each of us. As I think of the year he was killed, I realize this year is the same as how the days fall. And this afternoon, or maybe very shortly, Jerusalem time, he would awaken and then would step out of the tomb precisely 3 days after he was put in. You brought all of that to life today. Thanks so much. And then it says, thanks so much. I hope you and your dad will continue these live programs on the Sabbath. Well, we'll see how much longer it goes. This is from Australia. It says, just wanted to say thank you for all your efforts producing the Trumpet Daily. Tuning in to hear the real perspective on this whole COVID-19 drama has been a great blessing. Listening to your Friday TD, you mentioned Dr. Fauci saying, even though predictions have lowered dramatically, we can't let up lest it explode out of control. This is exactly what we're facing here in Australia. And he goes on to describe the few number of deaths they've had and how the people there are getting restless. And of course, they don't like seeing what's happening to the economy. And that's a very similar story to what's happening right around the world. Another one from Australia says, I want to thank you for this very timely feeding of God's word to us, the sheep. Truly, this message of yours has inspired me to draw closer to God and to obey God to the best of my ability, although by myself I cannot truly repent. However, after studying Bible lesson 9 and 10, I really do want to repent. I'm trying, but it's far from easy. May God continue to bless your work, and I would to support the work of this true church of God. One last one here from Texas, a regular listener, first time writing in though. It says, this is my first time contacting the show. We try never to miss a show during the week, and now having the extra special shows on the Sabbath has really enhanced our Sabbath keeping. It is wonderful to watch the TV, or rather the TD, live along with so many of the brethren around the world during this lockdown. It's so exciting to have an extra TD after all the weekly shows. says here also, you mentioned the BCC lesson 29 that you were reviewing for the Passover, and I too pulled out my copy and worked through it. It really added to my Passover this year. Now I'm continuing my study through lesson 30 on the days of unleavened bread. These lessons have really enhanced my understanding and keeping of God's spring festivals. So another plug there for the correspondence course, as I tried to give it on Saturday. But if you have the chance and are willing to invest the time into this course, not just lessons 29 and 30, but the entire 36-lesson course, it will help you get to know your Bible. If you follow the instructions that you find there in lesson one, it will keep your nose in the Bible, which is a wonderful thing, particularly given what's happening in the world today. I mentioned on the program Saturday, this former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb is his name, and he came out and said that coronavirus, it would have been worse, it would have been more deadly than the Spanish flu if it appeared in 1918. Now, I'm not sure how he came to this conclusion. He just said it. Coronavirus, so far, worldwide, it's over 100,000 deaths. The Spanish flu of 1918 killed an estimated 50 million people. 50 million people worldwide. And yet here he is. He's the FDA commissioner. And he just says, if this was then, it would be worse. So I'm not sure why he thinks there's not nearly as many casualties today. But even if you just step back, there's been some advancements coming out of World War I and, you know, obviously the problems with hygiene and the trenches and that sort of thing. Cleanliness, hygiene, perhaps there's been some advances there. But if you look at the Western diet 100 years ago, were we eating as much processed food? I don't know all these figures, but the world population then was 1.8 billion. Today it's 7.3 or 4 or whatever billion. So it's 3-4 times more populated, the earth today. And then you look at this disease, this virus, and the fact that it preys on to the tune of almost 99%. I think in some cases, a little more than 99%. Those that have some serious, serious underlying health conditions, like diabetes, like heart disease, like cancer. Did we have as many morbidly obese people in the world back in 1918? I don't have the studies in front of me to look exactly at the differences, but just a bit of common sense. I think for the most part, you would have had people with fewer chronic health conditions, or fewer people with chronic health conditions. And that's the ones who are most vulnerable to this coronavirus. The New York Times had, you can see where this is headed now as the deaths begin to decline. You can see, at least in the United States, what they're going to do with this story. They're going to take it and they're going to try to beat up the president of the United States with it on every opportunity that they have. The New York Times yesterday, they came out with the featured story in the Sunday paper. He could have seen what was coming behind Trump's failure on the virus. And you can look at this. You can look at this article. I think it has six authors, six people had to pitch in on this. This subject, President Trump's failures. The same president who put the ban on incoming flights from China on January 31st. And so they're going to go to great lengths to try to figure out where he failed. And really, you can see it. It's implied all throughout, but you're seeing people say it directly. This president killed people. He's responsible for the deaths of how many thousands? It says here, an examination reveals the president was warned about the potential for a pandemic, but that internal divisions, lack of planning, and his faith in his own instincts led to a halting response. He didn't do anything. The experts did everything right, but he didn't do anything right. He got it all wrong. We were off to a late start, and now we have all of these deaths. Compared to the Spanish flu, not nearly as many, but that's another subject altogether. He is responsible, says, throughout January, as Mr. Trump repeatedly played down the seriousness of the virus and focused on other issues, like impeachment, you might add. It says, an array of figures inside his government, from top White House advisors to experts deep in the cabinet departments and intelligence agencies, identified the threat, sounded alarms, and made clear the need for aggressive action. And we've played the montages before, all of these media types, all of these individuals in the media. They were downplaying it consistently. They said it was nothing worse than the flu. Nothing to be worried about. Now here we are. We're into April. The charts are beginning to go in the right direction. They're going down. And so you're going to have all of these people coming forward with their after reports to highlight all the supposed mistakes of this administration. It says, when Mr. Trump finally agreed in mid-March to recommend social distancing across the country, effectively bringing much of the economy to a halt, he seemed shell-shocked and deflated to some of his closest associates. Well, imagine that. He was shell-shocked. He was really discouraged by all of this. The destruction of the U.S. economy. The collapse of the stock market. This is the New York Times. Well, you remember the work of the experts. And I think that at least there'll be a few programs like this that will remind you of what they were saying, what the experts were saying back in January, what the experts were saying back in February, what the experts have said to contradict themselves and their models even just a few days ago. Dr. Fauci, speaking of the changing models and just the lowering of the estimates, this is what I think he said, what would it have been, maybe about a week ago, when he was asked, there was the bracket between 100,000 and 240,000 deaths. This had come down from 2.2 million estimated deaths in the United States. And then he was asked recently, well, what about that 100,000 to 240,000? And then this is what he said, clip one.
Do you think the number of fatalities in this country will be significantly lower than the 100,000 to 240,000 first projected?
I do. I believe we are going to see a downturn in that, and it looks more like the 60,000 than the 100 to 200,000. But having said that, we better be careful that we don't say, okay, we're doing so well, we could pull back.
So we got to keep all of the restrictions in place. It keeps dwindling, the estimate. But he says, we got to be careful. Now, keep in mind, she says, the journalist there says, what started at 240,000, it didn't start at 240,000. It started at over 2 million. 2.2 million. And now it's down to 60,000. What will it be down to in the next couple of days? Well, it doesn't matter now, because the New York Times has spoken in yesterday's Sunday paper. The New York Times has spoken, and everyone's going to be running with this angle. He could have stopped it. He could have stopped it if he would have acted. He could have seen what was coming. But he failed. Donald Trump failed. And people died. Listen to how Jake Tapper framed his questions yesterday in an interview with Dr. Fauci, clip two.
Do you think lives could have been saved if social distancing, physical distancing, stay-at-home measures had started third week of February instead of mid-March?
You know, Jake, again, it's the what would have, what could have. It's very difficult to go back and say that. I mean, obviously, you could logically say that if you had a process that was ongoing and you started mitigation earlier, you could have saved lives. Obviously, no one is going to deny that. But what goes into those kinds of decisions is complicated. But you're right. I mean, obviously, if we had right from the very beginning shut everything down, it may have been a little bit different. But there was a lot of pushback about shutting things down back then.
That's Dr. Fauci yesterday. Obviously, well, obviously, if we would have had these restrictions in place earlier, it could have saved lives. Just like if you would have put a ban on driving your car, that would obviously save some lives. It's obvious. It's obvious. If you put these kinds of restrictions in place, you know, it's how many lives are lost when 20 million people lose their jobs? It's obvious. It's obvious that when you have millions and millions and millions of people going jobless, that there will be casualties. You've got the numbers to prove it. You see, you can play with these numbers any way that you like, and that's what we see happening. These are the only deaths that matter. These are the only ones that matter. Listen to what Dr. Fauci said himself. Here he is saying, well, what if we would have put these in place in mid-February? That's how Jake Tapper asked the question. Well, listen to what Dr. Fauci said at the very end of February. This was February 29th. This was the day before the month of March. And he said this on NBC, clip 3.
So, Dr. Fauci, it's Saturday morning in America. People are waking up right now with real concerns about this. They want to go to malls and movies, maybe the gym as well. Should we be changing our habits? And if so, how?
No, right now, at this moment, there is no need to change anything that you're doing on a day-by-day basis. Right now, the risk is still low, but this could change. I've said that many times, even on this program. You've got to watch out because although the risk is low now, you don't need to change anything you're doing.
Now, he's the foremost expert on infectious disease in the United States. Where is the team of reporters at the New York Times with their article about that man? He could have seen what was coming. Why did he fail? Why did the models fail? Why do the models keep failing? An army of reporters, and the objective is to take down the president. It's the same story, it's just a different chapter. Dr. Fauci on February 29th, well, the risk is so low. We don't need to change anything that we're doing. So if he's advising the president on February the 29th, then how can you fault President Trump for doing what the experts suggested? Seems like he's done quite a lot of that in the last couple months. In the Los Angeles Times, by the way, another story you just don't... This is actually a refreshing piece about California. If you look at the daily tracker, everybody's glued to the screen. And we've commented before about why the rates of death are as high as they are in New York, in Queens, to be precise. But then by state, if you compare New York to California, California has 40 million people and not that many corona-related deaths. Why the difference? This is from the Los Angeles Times. It says the early COVID-19 deaths in San Francisco, it talks about a death in January and February, I think it was, but it says these early deaths suggest that the novel coronavirus had established itself in the community long before health officials started looking for it. The lag time has had dire consequences, allowing the virus to spread unchecked before social distancing rules went into effect. It says the virus was freewheeling in our community and probably has been here for quite some time. Dr. Jeff Smith, a physician who is the chief executive of Santa Clara County government, he told county leaders this in a briefing. How long? A study out of Stanford suggests a dramatic viral surge in February. So the article is saying that the virus was spreading rapidly before it really became a top story there at the tail end of February and, of course, the early part of March. But it says here, Smith on Friday said data collected by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, local health departments, and others suggest it was a lot longer than we first believed, most likely since back in December. So California, I think they've got more flights coming in from China than any other state, including from Wuhan. And so why isn't it more, why aren't there more cases? Why aren't there more deaths? Well, this is suggesting, as others have in recent weeks too, Victor Davis Hanson made a similar point in one of his columns recently, that they have more of a herd immunity because the sickness has already worked its way through a majority of the population, or maybe not a majority, but a lot of people in California, and you've read the articles about those who have very, very mild symptoms, younger people, healthier people that don't really show that many symptoms, but they nevertheless have the virus. It says, this wasn't recognized because we were having a severe flu season, Smith said in an interview. Symptoms are very much like the flu. If you got a mild case of COVID, you didn't really notice. You didn't even go to a doctor. The doctor maybe didn't even do it because they presumed it was the flu. So before we were really concerned as much about the Wuhan flu, the point that this article makes is that it probably raced through California earlier than other states, and we didn't really notice it because we were in the middle of a bad flu season anyway. So it just all got blended in. Now, speaking of that point, as far as a lot of people having gotten this, I think this was this particular doctor was on Fox last night or the other night talking about how that the mortality rate, because more and more people probably have gotten this without even knowing it, that then means the mortality rate for this particular virus is a fair bit lower than what was initially said by the WHO guy and you know other experts since. This is Stanford's Batacaria, I guess is how you say his name. Clip 4.
The key thing to know about this disease is that it is very contagious. Now, that sounds very scary, but but in some ways, it should be somewhat comforting. Why is that? Because if it's contagious and it's widespread, then the death rate from it is actually much lower than we believe. You've seen very, very scary numbers, I think. The original report suggested 3% mortality rate. 3 in 100 people die from getting the disease. But if the denominator is much larger than that, and in fact, it almost certainly is much larger than that, if many, many, many people got the disease that that we didn't pick up with the testing regimen we had, well, then the mortality rate's much lower than that. Maybe 1 in 1,000. It could be much lower. Sure.
So we'll know a lot more months down the road when, like, the CDC and other outfits like that are able to compile all of the stats and they have a pretty good idea of how many people actually got this virus. But I think another telling stat months from now will just be the overall mortality rate in the United States. The CDC puts out its weekly updates. Every year in the United States, there's something like 2.85 million Americans that die, and the leading causes of death, cancer, heart disease, medical mistakes, by the way. But you can look at this chart that we've put together, and you can see that coming up through March, now maybe April will be quite a lot different because that's when we've seen all the figures on the ticker, the daily tracker, that have gone up in Italy, in Europe, in the United States, and so on. But up through March, just the total number of deaths, you can see 2020 on this chart here, that's in the red. And so through March, we actually lost fewer Americans overall than last year and also compared to 2018. Now, 2018 was when there was a particularly brutal flu season. So 2.8 whatever million per year, that amounts to about 57,000, 58,000 Americans per week that are dying. And if you examine this chart, look at some of the figures. In 2018, week in and week out, Americans, there were 66,000 in the month of January, 67,000 that died in the first week of 2018. And you compare it to the numbers this year, where it's 59,000, 57,000 in week three, 55,000 in week seven. And it's actually been trending downward, or at least it did through the 13th week in March. I think that's through March 28th, something like that. It's actually below 50,000 for week 12. So we'll see if April really turns that upward sharply because of all of these corona deaths, or if you remember that story we had a couple weeks ago, Neil Ferguson, he's the one that came out with the scaremongering, the model that said if we didn't do like China, then millions were going to die in the United States and in the UK. When he backtracked from that, then he came out and said, you know, there'll be as many as 20,000 deaths. And really, as far as the overall mortality rate, you probably won't even notice it much over the course of the year because these were people that would have died anyway. So here in the UK, it's something like 600,000 die every year. So when we get to the end of this year and the final stats are compiled, whether for the UK or the US, I think that will tell the story most of all. How much did it really impact the population? There was a story in Off Guardian. We didn't get a chance to go through this, but this was, again, from March 30th. It says, COVID-19 yet to impact Europe's overall mortality. Now, again, April may be different. Maybe it will impact Europe. I think this particular website that this article refers to, it's yet to impact Europe's overall mortality. It has maps that, just like the CDC would have, where it adjusts every week as to, are we at a high death period for Italy, let's say, or for the Netherlands, or for Germany, or is it average, or is it a little bit lower? And it really, as far as late March is concerned, it was only Italy that was registering a mortality rate that was unusually high, or higher than usual. The London Times, this is from that March 26th, the one where, well, I guess I don't need to quote it. It's the one where Neil Ferguson basically said that these corona-related deaths are going to basically blend in and you won't notice that big of a difference just because of the number of deaths that we typically have each year. Going back to the start of April, the CDC came out with guidelines with respect to COVID-19 and how to calculate these deaths. And I'll just quote from it. It's from their April report, and I think it appeared maybe at the tail end of March or April 1st. But it says here, in cases where a definite diagnosis of COVID-19 cannot be made, but it is suspected or likely, the circumstances are compelling within a reasonable degree of certainty, it says it is acceptable to report COVID-19 on a death certificate as probable or presumed. It says in these instances, certifiers should use their best clinical judgment in determining if a COVID-19 infection was likely. So basically they're saying, these are the guidelines. If you as a doctor, if you don't have time to even test them, but you suspect that it might be COVID-19 related, or you suspect that it might be corona related, go ahead and mark it down. Cause of death, coronavirus. And this seems like a very unscientific way to report these deaths. But you see, again, there's quite a lot of pressure coming from a lot of different angles to get these numbers as high as they can get. Because after all, the experts, the models, think about what they've been saying. And so we've got to show, Jake Tapper has to have the figures to be able to show that President Trump killed Americans. Thousands upon thousands of people are dying. That's the narrative. The Telegraph, remember that story from a week or two ago where we reported that in Italy, Well, according to this one expert, he came out and said that they're reporting them the wrong way there as well. Everything fell into that category of corona death, even when there were some severe underlying health conditions. Listen to Dr. Birx. This is the lady on President Trump's corona task force. And she was asked about these CDC guidelines that came out a couple of weeks ago and how they're tracking corona-related deaths. This is clip six.
Can you talk about your concerns about deaths being misreported by coronavirus because of either lack of testing or standards for how they're characterized?
So I think in this country, we've taken a very liberal approach to mortality. And I think the reporting here has been pretty straightforward over the last 5 to 6 weeks. Prior to that, when there wasn't testing in January and February, that's a very different situation and unknown. There are other countries that if you had a pre-existing condition, and let's say the virus caused you to go to the ICU and then have a heart or kidney problem, some countries are recording that as a heart issue or a kidney issue and not a COVID-19 death. Right now, we're still recording it, and the great thing about having forms that come in and a form that has the ability to mark it as COVID-19 infection, the intent is right now that those, if someone dies with COVID-19, we are counting that as a COVID-19 death.
She says if someone dies with COVID-19, we're counting that. So the difference, of course, being that if you die of some other disease and you happen to have COVID, that's very different than being relatively healthy and dying from COVID. COVID was the cause. And as she said there, the U.S. is taking a very liberal approach to this mortality rate, to the lethality of corona. Listen to a doctor. This is a Minnesota senator, Scott Jensen. And he's commenting here, I forget which interview this was from, but he's commenting here on these new guidelines from the CDC and how far doctors can now go to say that is a corona death. Here's Minnesota Senator Dr. Scott Jensen, clip seven.
Well, last Friday, I received a 7-page document that sort of told me that if I had an 86-year-old patient that had pneumonia but was never tested for COVID-19, but sometime after she came down with pneumonia, we learned that she had been exposed to her son who had no symptoms but later on was identified with COVID-19, that it would be appropriate to diagnose on the death certificate COVID-19. Now, we've not done that. If someone has the pneumonia after and it's in the middle of a flu epidemic and I don't have a test on influenza, I don't diagnose influenza on the death certificate.
So he's saying in a normal year, he's a doctor. He's saying in a normal year, if someone has pneumonia and dies, but it's right in the middle of a really bad flu season, he's not going to mark it down as, well, he died of the flu. He's going to mark it down as a pneumonia death, a death as a result of pneumonia. He went on to say in this same interview, clip eight.
I went to the person in our office who does most of the death certificates over the last, 10, 20 years. And I said, does this sound right? I had her look at the documents that I printed off. And she said, well, we've always been told that you always put down just facts. You don't put down any probabilities. You don't put any presumptions down. It's just what you know. And so this is concerning.
But you see, the models themselves, it's all based on probabilities and presumptions. And now even the gathering of the facts afterward, that's based, as he said there, on probabilities and presumptions. Well, he probably died of corona, so let's just go mark it down as such. I think this was on Laura Ingraham's show, but it's the same senator, and I think this is from last week, clip nine.
The
determination of the cause of death is a big deal. It has impact on estate planning. It has impact on future generations. And the idea that we're going to allow people to massage and sort of game the numbers is a real issue, because we're going to undermine the trust. And right now, as we see politicians doing things that aren't necessarily motivated on fact and science, the public's going to, their trust in politicians is already wearing thin.
So there he was explaining that. And then he goes on to, again, talk about how it was done just in a normal circumstance where the flu, let's say, is part of the equation. Clip 10.
Let's just take influenza. If I have a patient died a month ago, had fever, cough, and died after 3 days, and maybe had been an elderly, fragile individual, and there happened to be an influenza epidemic around our community, I wouldn't put influenza on the death certificate, and I've never been encouraged to do so. I would put probably respiratory arrest would be the top line, and the underlying cause of disease would be pneumonia. And in the contributing factors, I might well put emphysema or congestive heart failure. But I would never put influenza down as the underlying cause of death. And yet that's what we're being asked to do here.
It's totally different guidelines for this pandemic. And of course, I talked a little bit about political motivation in some of these cases, but it's also, as he points out, it's also to their interest financially to be able to mark these down in such a way. Listen to him explain that, clip 11.
Anytime healthcare intersects with dollars, it gets awkward. Right now, Medicare has determined that if you have a COVID-19 admission to the hospital, you'll get paid $13,000. If that COVID-19 patient goes on a ventilator, you get $39,000, three times as much. Nobody can tell me after 35 years in the world of medicine that sometimes those kinds of things impact on what we do.
So you see again the possibility here for human nature to just run its course in every aspect of this story. The New York Times, the CDC came out with those guidelines at the end of the week, not last week, but the week before. And naturally, there were a few blogs and such that said, well, why are you kind of liberalizing your standards here? They got some criticism for it. And so right on cue, then the New York Times comes out the following Monday with its defense of the CDC guidelines. And listen to how far they take it. This is from April 5th. It says a coroner in Indiana wanted to know if the coronavirus had killed a man in early March, but said that her health department denied a test. It says paramedics in New York City say that many patients who died at home were never tested for the coronavirus, even if they showed telltale signs of infection. Now, you keep in mind what Dr. Birx said in that clip I just played. She said, we've taken a very liberal view in the way we compile these stats and have been for the last 5-6 weeks. Now, before that, well, there's really no way of knowing for sure, because then the guidelines were pretty much like they had always been. It says here, in Virginia, a funeral director prepared the remains of three people after health workers cautioned her that they each had tested positive for the coronavirus, but only one of the three had the virus noted on the death certificate. It says here, and this is the key point, across the U.S., even as coronavirus deaths are being recorded in terrifying numbers, many hundreds each day, the true death toll is likely much higher. So here's the liberal spin. Here they've lowered the guidelines so that they can get more people tacked onto the death toll. And the New York Times comes along and says, yeah, that's the way the guidelines should have been all along. And for that reason, there's actually a lot more corona-related deaths. So the battle for the narrative, we're in the midst of that now. Because the narrative's got to be used to try to destroy the president. Thousands and thousands and thousands are dying. And it's because of President Trump. The Times says here, more than 9,400 people with the coronavirus have been reported to have died in this country as of this weekend. This is, again, last week. So it's the tracker's up to 22,000 or whatever it might be at the moment. This is a little bit dated, but it says here, but hospital officials, doctors, public health experts, and medical examiners say that official counts have failed to capture the true number of Americans dying in this pandemic. But see, the problem with this, the problem with all of this is that if they're right, if like the Los Angeles Times says, if the virus ripped through California in December, January, February, and now they've got the herd immunity, it all kind of got blended into, a bad flu season. And then if the Times, the New York Times says here, if all of this was going on back in January and February and it wasn't being calculated the right way, well, then surely you would see a pretty big spike in the overall mortality rate. And as I showed you earlier, the first 3 months of this year, it's actually trended downward. It's going in the wrong direction for the experts, I mean. It's going in the right direction as far as people's lives are concerned. But up through March, we had fewer deaths in the United States than we did at the same time last year and that we did in 2018. That's according to the CDC. It says here, and this is back to the New York Times, in many rural areas, coroners say they don't have the tests they need to detect the disease. Doctors now believe that some deaths in February and early March before the coronavirus reached epidemic levels in the U.S. were likely misidentified as influenza or only described as pneumonia. See, that's not the way we do it now. As of 2 weeks ago or a few weeks ago, the new guidelines say, you say it's corona. And now, even if you suspect it, then use your better judgment as a physician, as a doctor, to go ahead and mark it down as such. It says, with no uniform system for reporting coronavirus-related deaths in the U.S. and a continued shortage of tests, some states and counties have improvised, obfuscated, and at times backtracked in counting the dead. So here comes the New York Times. And of course, once they give the cue, then everybody in the media, they're right on board with it. That's what led to the exchange I played for you between that reporter and Dr. Birx, who very openly said, we take a very liberal approach to the mortality rate. We have been for 5-6 weeks. Listen to Dr. Fauci. He's asked, what about those that would say, well, if you have these kinds of lax guidelines, wouldn't that inflate the numbers of corona-related deaths? And this is how Dr. Fauci responded to that last week, clip 12.
You weighed in on a theory that's been floating around that perhaps the number of fatalities related to COVID-19 is being inflated because people are actually dying of other things. What's your read on that theory?
You know, Savannah, there is absolutely no evidence that that's the case at all. You know, I think it falls under the category of something that's very unfortunate, these conspiracy theories that we hear about. Every time we have a crisis of any sort, there's always this popping up of conspiracy theories. I think the deaths that we're seeing are coronavirus deaths, and the other deaths are not being counted as coronavirus deaths.
So that's Dr. Fauci last week saying that if you even ask about the stats, then you're into the world of conspiracy theories. So you can't even question the experts. You have all of these doctors all across the United States, and even the New York Times says there's no real uniform system of reporting all this, but they just know for sure that it's really, really bad. And it's even worse than what's been reported. And it's probably going to get worse in the summer. It's going to come back in the fall. And we just take their word for it because the experts say it. The experts also said, by the way, that the hospitals are going to be overrun. There's not going to be enough beds. There's not going to be enough ventilators. This is also from the New York Times. A week and a half ago, says here, as hospitals across the country brace for an onslaught, this is April 3rd, as they brace for an onslaught of coronavirus patients, doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers, even in emerging hotspots, are being furloughed, reassigned, or told they must take pay cuts. It's from the New York Times. And you've seen stories like this right across the country. You may have saw the headline last week. I think it was from Friday, where they built this makeshift hospital facility in one of the football stadiums in Seattle, anticipating, what does it use there? Onslaught. Anticipating an onslaught of patients. And they finally had to tear it down in Seattle and send it somewhere else that needs it. Because the onslaught didn't really happen. From all that we can tell, it's mostly in Queens. It's mostly in New York City. And even there, the president sent in that Navy ship. They too built this temporary hospital facility. Lots and lots of beds still available there. And then you have these stories of hospitals cutting back on their staff at a pandemic of all times. This is the pandemic of 2020. I saw a story a couple weeks ago from the Boston area. Boston's another big city, another sprawling metropolis. And one hospital there cut back 10% of its staff. They don't have as much work. Well, people are being told, if you've got, you know, some kind of non-essential condition, now's not the time to go deal with it. So hospitals are going broke, some of them. They're not getting enough business. Have you heard that much on the news? It says the job cuts, which stretch from Massachusetts to Nevada, are a new and possibly urgent problem for a business-oriented healthcare system whose hospitals must earn revenue even in a national crisis. What a mess. Total mess. It says hospitals large and small have canceled many elective services, often under state government orders, as they prepare for the virus, sending revenues plummeting. So the hospitals are being hit. They don't have enough business. And, you know, you put two and two together. These are just based on my models as I sit around and think about these stats and these figures. If 250,000 Americans die each year because of medical malpractice, because of mistakes made at hospitals, and people are staying away from hospitals, in my mind, that means there's fewer mistakes being made, which could possibly mean fewer people are dying. That's the Trumpet Daily Radio Show model. I don't think it's going to get as much traction as Neil Ferguson's. It says, according to a statistical model, well, here we go. This is the New York Times, produced by Health Landscape and the American Academy of Family Physicians. By the end of April, nearly 20,000 family physicians could be fully out of work. Think of it. 20,000 family physicians out of work by the end of this month. 20,000 doctors out of work during the pandemic of 2020. Tucker Carlson reported on this phenomenon last week, on his program, Clip 5.
Across the country, healthcare workers are being let go or furloughed. Elective procedures have been canceled. That means there aren't patients for them to care for. Hospitals are running short on cash. In Oklahoma City, an entire hospital has been closed, except for its emergency room. Almost everywhere except the New York metro area, Detroit and New Orleans, hospitals, many of them, are sitting half empty or empty, thanks to a lockdown meant to ease pressure on hospitals. That's a story none of us expected to see. It's all pretty shocking, given what we expected. But the weirdest thing of all is how little attention this is all getting.
Nobody cares. Nobody talks about it. 20,000 family physicians out of work by the end of this month. It's the same here in the UK. Remember, this was all given as justification for a Chinese communist-style lockdown. It's not going to save everybody, but we've got to flatten the curve. We can't have everybody running into the NHS here in the UK. It'll destroy the system. It'll bring down the whole nationalized healthcare system if we do that. So we need a lockdown. And we need to tell hospitals, look, if it's non-essential, just focus on the onslaught. Focus on the onslaught. Don't attend to any of these other matters. And so, well, what's happened? There's still people dying, just like people are dying every day from other diseases. This is from the Daily Telegraph a few days ago, and it's about the month of March. A total of 1.53 million attendances recorded in March is a 29% drop on 2.17 million attendances in the same month last year. So the hospitals, at least for the month of March, they've seen a 29% drop in work, I guess, however you want to describe it. They don't have as many attendances. That's a staggering figure when you think of it. To go from 2.17 million to 1.5 million, and you wonder why you're seeing some of these little videos on social media of all these doctors and these physicians, you know, doing dances with music and whatever else. I don't want to make light of the situation for those that really have struggled and suffered. But outside of a few, just a few areas, Northern Italy, Queens, there has been no run on the hospitals. Far from it. In the UK, it's taken a 29% drop during the pandemic of 2020. These figures don't add up. And like Tucker Carlson said, nobody talks about it. A hospital closing in Oklahoma? The makeshift hospital in Seattle that's preparing for the onslaught? Just quietly closing up shop? It says gravely ill people are staying away from hospital due to coronavirus, with a lower number of A&E visits last month than at any time since current records began. Let me just read that again. Lower number of A&E visits to the NHS since any time, since the keeping of records began. That is astounding to me. It says medical leaders are appealing for patients with serious conditions to continue using the NHS after the first official data since the lockdown began revealed a 29% drop. So they're out there begging for customers. It says here, NHS England said the fall was likely to be the result of the COVID-19 response. So they're not stupid. They see that, well, it's because of the panic. You lock everyone down and people start, well, they stay in their homes instead of going to the hospital, when that generally was what they did on a whim, really. It's free. It's a nationalized health service, so if I've got this or that, I might as well go in. Well, now they're not going in. There's this article at the Federalist, by the way. You recall early on in the crisis with New York, I think New York had 5,000 ventilators, and Governor Cuomo said we need another 26,000. So he needed over 30,000 ventilators. And President Trump said, well, I think that's exaggerated. I don't think they're going to need that many at all. And, of course, President Trump was made to be the idiot, judging by the media reaction. This is Molly Hemingway at the Federalist. It says, President Trump was pilloried by the media for questioning whether New York would actually need 30,000 additional ventilators. It says, new models from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation. So here's some new models, some more models, but this one's, it's more accurate. It says it shows that New York already reached its peak projected ventilator usage on April 8th, when a projected need of 5,008, the actual use may have been even lower. So it turns out that New York only needed 5,000. That's about what New York had. Somebody's going to have a lot of extra ventilators laying around once this disease is finally over. It says in late March, well, backing up, as of press time, no media outlets revisited their reporting on the matter. That's just the thing, you see? It's like Tucker Carlson said, there's going to be a run on the hospitals. And when that doesn't happen, they don't come back and report on it. They've moved on to another shiny object by that point. We're going to need 30,000 ventilators. I think this is a direct quote from Cuomo. Cuomo was upset that the Trump administration had not acquiesced to his request and asked them to pick the 26,000 people who are going to die. That's a quote from the governor of New York. When Donald Trump just pushed back ever so slightly, he says, if you don't give me these 26,000 extra ones, then you come to New York and pick which 26,000 people are going to die. Yep, just another day of reporting. Just another news conference from the governor of New York. This was just a few weeks ago. Not even that. Just a week or two ago. And now what do we find out? Well, actually, they only needed 5,000. This just goes on, and it's never ending. The cycle of errors, catastrophic errors, based on models, based on presumptions. Precious, precious little is based on anything factual. How can you believe anything that's reported today? Well, there's a lot of other numbers that we'd like to crunch. We'll certainly keep track of the overall mortality rate. Even as this year unfolds, it'll be revealing to get to the end of April. Some of these stats don't come in right away. In any event, they do paint a pretty compelling picture. That's all that I have time for, though, today. I had some other material, but we'll reserve it for tomorrow. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.